Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Miles Gibrani loves America. He moved here early in elementary school and, like a lot of immigrant kids, found himself quickly enthralled by and comfortable with U.S. culture. U.S. culture, on the other hand, has sometimes been less than receptive. Gibrani's family escaped from Iran ahead of the revolution of 1979 and just a year before the start of the Iran hostage crisis. He and his siblings adjusted quickly to their new home and the unspoken rules that allowed them to fit in, lessons his Rolls-Royce driving father never quite mastered. As he grew up, Gibrani made plenty of friends, but also suffered bullying from classmates who assumed an Iranian kid must be a terrorist, and later discovered that many adult American casting directors assumed the same thing, or at least figured that was the only character he could convincingly play. Gibrani shares the story of coming to terms with his identity and his decision to stop playing into stereotypes, even if it cost him work, in his new book, I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. Maz, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
How does a kid born in Iran, raised in Northern California, become obsessed with Dallas, Texas?
Well, that's I think that was all in the timing. It came to America late 78, and that's when the Cowboys were America's team. And I had a friend of mine who just said, listen, you got to root for Tony Dorsett, Danny White, Tom Landry, Ed Tuttle Jones, all those guys. And I was like, oh, this is it. I'm into it. And so I had him. I had my friend who was telling me to root for the Cowboys. And then I had the women in my family who were obsessed with the TV show Dallas. So it was a double whammy. So I had no hope.
And then when you finally had a chance to come and work here, someone left you with the impression that the only entertainment option for a young single guy was a strip club.
Yeah, it was interesting because it was my first time going to Dallas, and I was there to work on a Chuck Norris movie of the week. And I was there with another friend of mine, and another actor from the film. And so we would ask people, say, where should we go? And everyone said, oh, you got to go to strip clubs. And I was like, well, there's got to be somewhere else to go out, right? No, strip clubs. It's all strip clubs. It was like that was constantly what we were being pushed to go to. And I was like, all right, when in Rome.
Well, you should come back. We have a beautiful arts district now and, gardens and lots of other things to do as well.
I've been back a lot since because I come back and I perform at the Addison Improv a mm-hmm. lot. And I'll be honest, I've had some great experiences. I've ended up downtown at some great bars and restaurants. So, yeah, I think maybe it was just the crew that I was talking to at the time.
All right, so this Chuck Norris film, essentially your function was to play a terrorist physicist who is about to nuke a building but instead gets his tail kicked by Mr. Norris. Is that about correct?
Yeah, that was very well summed up.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was pre-9/11, and there was, Chuck Norris was doing Walker, Texas Ranger, so I think in between those he would do this these movie of the weeks for movies of the week mm-hmm. for CBS, and this one was called The President's Man, A Line in the Sand. And so there was this this group that were being run by an Osama bin Laden type. And I was the guy working for him. I was the physicist who he'd sent to Chicago to blow up a building in Chicago. And we were filming this down in Dallas. And it was interesting because at the time I had a day job. In my real life, I still had a day job, and I was thinking, this is an opportunity to get an acting gig that will help me quit my day job, basically. So I said, I don't care what the part is, I'm going to do it. And I also thought that maybe I can, through my acting, I can show why this guy had chosen to go to Chicago to blow up a building. Maybe I could show his angst. Maybe I could bring some of my great thespian training to this. And it really hit me when I went in for the wardrobe fitting, and they said, here's your shirt, here's your pants, and here's your turban. And I said, whoa. I said, wait a minute. I said, I'm trying to get this right, okay? I said, Afghans in America don't wear turbans. Indian Sikhs wear turbans. Afghans do not wear turbans. And the poor wardrobe girl was like, dude, this is a Chuck Norris movie. What are you talking about? And I got in this argument with her, and I was like, please. I go, you got to tell these guys. Talk to the producers. And she's like, okay, I'll talk to the producers. and tell them you don't want to wear the turban. And so the next day when I showed up at my trailer where my clothes were, there was my shirt and my pants and what looked like a scarf. So I said, see, I said, all you have to do is talk to them. I will gladly be the scarf wearing terrorist. She's like, that's not a scarf. That's the turban. You got to wrap it back up. And I was like, oh, man. So I ended up wearing the turban and felt like an idiot.
It's a great story to start with, though, because the book is a lot about the fact that you have this really American identity, but it seems that a lot of your fellow Americans have wanted over time to define you differently.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. I mean, I personally, growing up, when I started doing plays when I was 12 years old in junior high school, I was a big fan of Eddie Murphy's. I wanted to be like Eddie Murphy, and I fell in love with being on stage. And at the time, one of the first plays I got to do was Little Abner. I got to play Little Abner in a play. And then in high school, I got to play, we did a play, a Batman play. I got to play Batman. I got to play all these different parts. Now, that said, I also enjoyed playing characters with accents. I was a big fan of Peter Sellers, so I loved that as well. But what happened was I thought, okay, I'll go to Hollywood and I'll get to play French guys and Mexican guys and non-accented guys and all the different parts. And I've had a chance to do a lot of those different parts throughout my career. But early on in my career, I realized quickly that, sure, those parts will come up from time to time, but 9 times out of 10, the parts that come up for someone that is of Middle Eastern background are terrorist parts. And that just started bothering me at a certain point. And I thought, wow, there's got to be more to people from my background than just terrorists. But unfortunately, the roles that are written are those roles. And ultimately, I don't lay the blame on Hollywood. I think the blame falls a little bit on the shoulders of people from those backgrounds, people like myself and other actors and other people. You know, we need to start writing different stories and telling different stories to create those parts. Because ultimately, if we're waiting on Hollywood to do it, they're always going to say, okay, well, who's the bad guy in this Bruce Willis movie? Well, it should be it's going to be a Middle Eastern terrorist guy. You know, who's the bad guy in this Schwarzenegger movie? A Middle Eastern terrorist guy. I mean, that's just what it is.
Your grandmother at one point said, when are you going to stop being in movies where you get killed every time?
Yeah, that was my mother,
Your mother.
Yeah, it's actually funny. My mother, in the book, I exaggerate my mother, and I write about that in the introduction where I say some of the things that she says aren't verbatim what she said. It's more what I felt like she was saying to me. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have that with our parents when they say something, you know, especially when you have immigrant parents. If they say... like my mom would say things like, why can't you be like so-and-so's kid? He's getting straight A's and his room is always clean. And to me, that would read as, I wish I never would have had you. I should have just left you back in Iran when I came to America. So my mom is an interesting character because she was very much against me pursuing acting and comedy and this life professionally. Because when immigrant parents come to America, they want their kids to be lawyers and doctors.
Right.
And ultimately, when I told her that I'm going to pursue it, she went from wanting me to be a lawyer to then saying, okay, listen, at least be a mechanic. And I was like, how'd you go from lawyer to mechanic? There's a lot of jobs in between. And she goes, listen, people need mechanics. Nobody needs an actor. I was like, those are wise words. And ultimately, when I started doing the acting, she came around. And I think that she just, at a certain point, you know, if you watch your son die a few times on a TV show, it's like, okay, I've had enough. I you've got to do other parts. Play a doctor, you know.
Your dad, on the other hand, when you said, I want to be an actor, thought that this was your roundabout way of telling him you were gay.
Yeah, it's funny because my dad, he never came out and said, oh, are you gay? I mean, I say it as what I felt him thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, the way they would treat you when you would say, I want to be an actor, they would say, oh, okay. All right, but listen, but really, what you need to do, fine, do your plays on the weekend, and then you can be my assistant at work. The truth is, I always thought my dad wanted me to be, because he was a businessman, so I thought that he wanted me to be a businessman as well. And I remember one summer he said, you come with me, we're going to go do some work. And I realized his work was just taking these lunch meetings, and all I would do is carry his briefcase. I was like, wait a minute, this is not fun. And in the book I think that he just wanted me to get my law degree so that I could be his consigliere. he could get free legal advice from me. That's what he wanted.
There's a sweet story about your dad, though, having a soft spot for like anybody who had financial trouble. And basically he would buy whatever friends and neighbors and colleagues had to sell. They could go to your dad and sell whether he needed it or not. He would buy it.
Listen, my dad, and I describe him the closest I could describe him is he was like Vito Corleone from The Godfather. Mm-hmm. He was this gregarious guy, and he was a self-made millionaire. He had an electric company in Iran, and he was a self-made millionaire, and he brought a lot of that money to America and ultimately lost it in bad real estate investments. But before he lost the money, exactly what you just said, all of his friends, whenever they would have financial troubles, they would just go to my dad. And my dad would buy whatever they had. So in the intro, you mentioned the Rolls Royce. That was a true... He didn't go to a Rolls Royce dealer to buy the Rolls Royce. A friend of his had bought a Rolls Royce, run into financial troubles, and my dad said, no problem, I buy the Rolls Royce. So next thing I know, here we are, you know, the Iran hostage crisis is going on, and my father's driving me around in a Rolls Royce in Tiburon, California, which is an affluent... city and county, but it's a lot more subtle. I say in the book, I go, the rich people in Tiburon drove Volvos and Saabs. My dad's driving a Rolls. And it was embarrassing. I literally would duck underneath in the back sometimes when he would pass some of the kids, because I was like, okay, this is really playing into the oil well stereotype of the oil well owning Middle Eastern guy. And then I also talk about in the book how one time he actually did this. He bought a bunch of phones. I guess one of his friends needed money and had extra phones. So my dad came home with like 10 phones. We didn't have anywhere to put them. We just ended up leaving them in the kitchen cupboard, and he would like give it away to friends as they would be leaving the house once in a while.
You do, of course, recognize, and you acknowledge this in the book, like lots of people's immigrant stories are harder than like, oh, it was awful because my dad drove me to soccer practice in a Rolls Royce and that made childhood tough.
Absolutely. I talk about feeling guilty about it, because to this day, you know, you don't know what people go through until you open up a conversation with them. You could be at a Starbucks talking to your buddy thinking, oh, here we are, both of us getting Frappuccinos. And you bring up the question of how did you come to America? And they open up. And a friend of mine actually did this recently. My friend, I was talking to him. I had no idea how he got to America. He goes, yeah, you know, I was in Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. And my parents were feeling that I might have to go to the military, so they got me out through Pakistan. I had to escape and be smuggled through Pakistan. And I was like, really?
Wow.
Like, yeah. And you go, wow, like this guy, and he had to live away from his family for a while. And all these, I'm telling you, there's so many people that have these stories. It's not just Iranians. I think a lot of different immigrants have these stories. And I say in the book, I feel guilty because I flew first class on Pan Am straight to New York Plaza Hotel across from FAO Schwartz. And when I first got here, I was like, wow, this revolution is really working out for me. I was a 6-year-old kid. It was great. You know? Yeah.
We're speaking this hour with actor, comedian, and writer Maz Jobrani. His new memoir is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Iranian-American actor, comedian, and writer Maz Jobrani, whose new memoir is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. Maz, I'm sorry. I almost couldn't help it. I know you hate that song. It came out when you were how old? Like 10, 11?
Yeah, I think that was the age. It's funny because listening to it now, it's actually kind of a catchy song. I kind of like it. But the way they would tease you back then is just because the name Iran,
yeah.
And they, you know, kids would say I ran so far. Okay, it's not even that funny. You're just mispronouncing Iran and you're saying Iran. There was a few songs actually. Somebody just brought up to my attention that back then there was this song ma Sharona,
yeah,
and I guess Dr. Demento or somebody had done it as Ayatollah. So there was we were a good target back then. I think the only thing that helped Iranian kids back then were that the Russians were still bad guys, so that took a little bit of heat off of us.
It must have been weird as a kid because, you know, I remember being that age, and it's just when kids start to hear things filtered down from their parents, but they may not really understand anything, but they want something to grab onto anyway to cause anybody else to be different. Can you talk a little bit about, like sometimes you, I guess you have to try to fight back, and other times you just sort of avoid kids who were bigger than you. What did you learn about managing the people that you knew would mess with you simply because you were Iranian?
You know, there's a couple things that I realized. First of all, I think if I ever went to a therapist and really looked into it, it's possible that I decided to be funny because it was a good way to deal with some of the issues as a kid coming from Iran to America. I didn't just change schools. I changed countries.
Yeah.
And suddenly the country I came from became public enemy number one, and I had nothing to do with it. But suddenly you go, oh, wow, there's a big spotlight on me and I fit this profile and these kids want to mess with me. So I think being funny helped. The other thing was I was a good athlete, so that helped. The third thing I realized, this is a little bit of my own therapy to myself. I realized that as a kid, I'd go shopping with my mom, and when we were grocery shopping, I would buy a ton of junk food. Just ton of candy, and she would make my lunch in one bag, and then I'd have another bag filled with candy. And when I go to school, I would just be passing out candy to all the to everybody to try and make friends. And I realized early I learned how to bribe people to make friends, because ultimately, like you said, these kids were, even if they were trying to avoid it, it was all over the news. Ted Koppel every night, you know, day 122, day 123, just every day. It was the front page news everywhere. And it was Iran this, Iran that, Iran this, Ayatollah that. So, yeah, I just dealt with it however I could. I tried to laugh and bribe and kickball and anything that it, whatever it took to blend in and make friends.
Do you remember now how your vision of what the U.S. would be, what it looked like before you actually came and moved here?
As a kid in Iran, I didn't know what the U.S. was, because I left when I was 6 years old. I didn't know much about the U.S. I did know the culture of the U.S., because I think that's what we do very well. We export our culture very well. So as a kid in Iran, I was a big fan of the movie Rocky had come out recently. I went and saw it as a kid, which also plays into the fact that we didn't have any movie rating systems. I was 5 years old seeing Rocky. So there was that. There was Spider-Man. There was Batman, Muhammad Ali, Zorro, Orange Fanta Soda, although it was Canada Dry that made it. But it was just this life as hamburgers. I mean, that's American. All this stuff as a kid, I didn't know how to differentiate it. I just thought, oh, this is great. So when I moved from Iran to America, the cultural part of it wasn't that different. It was more of the same. But I guess what Iran became after the revolution, when it became very anti-American, maybe then it would have been hard. If I'd been in Iran, maybe at that point it would have been hard for me to have American cultural references. But as a kid in Iran before the revolution, I grew up kind of like a kid in America.
It's sort of poignant that your parents so did not expect things to last, the upheaval to last, that when they first arrived here with you, they had left your baby brother back in Iran thinking, we'll just be gone for a couple of weeks and then we'll come back.
Yeah, again, this is something that's very interesting to me. Whenever I talk to other Iranians who came to America around that same time, they have a very similar story. I think that a lot of people had been living under the Shah and felt that the Shah had control of the country. And a lot of people thought, nah, it's not. There's not going to be a real revolution. It kind of reminds me of what I was watching when a few years ago, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. I think some Egyptians had gotten so used to him leading the country that when the protests began, I'm sure there was a lot of Egyptians who thought, oh, these will die out. So we literally, it was our winter break for my sister and I towards the end of 78, and my father was on business in New York, and he told my mom, why don't you bring me and my sister for the 2-week break? And we left my baby brother back in Iran, and we thought we'd be gone for 2 weeks. And I always say we packed for 2 weeks and we stayed for 35 years.
How would you describe the Iranian sense of humor?
It's interesting. The Iranian sense of humor, first of all, one of the beautiful things that I did not intend to run into, but I did as a comedian, is exposing Iranians and other Middle Easterners laughing to an American audience. Meaning, when I think a lot of Americans don't even know that people from that part of the world laugh. And it wasn't until we did the Axis of Evil comedy tour, and it came out on Comedy Central, and I started reading on a conservative website, some people were talking, and one guy wrote another guy, said, I never knew these people laughed. And what it is there's audience shots in that first special that we did with Axis Evil of people from the Middle East or Middle Eastern background laughing. And so one thing is that the Iranian culture has a rich history of humor. And a lot of the comedy, a lot of our comedy is joke telling. It's, a guy walks into a bar with, a rabbi, a priest, and a whatever, those kinds of jokes. But we don't have stand-up comedy is not as well-known or as integrated into the Iranian culture. So for someone to go up on stage and talk about their real-life issues and make those funny, I don't think that, culturally speaking, we have that. So what happens sometimes is the younger generation, when I'm doing stand-up in America and or anywhere in the world, the younger generations that come out who are now have been exposed to stand-up comedy, they understand when I'm using sarcasm or irony. The older generation, unfortunately, I think doesn't understand irony, and they don't get sarcasm as much. And it's a cultural thing as well. So, for example, if I do a joke, nowadays where I talk about my mother advising me not to put my money into a 401k because there might be a revolution. So she says, keep the money close in case a revolution happens. So she says, keep the money under the mattress, keep it in the walls, do like your grandmother, put your money in your bra, which is where my grandmother used to keep all her money. And then jokingly I say, yeah, we used to think my grandmother was a D cup until one day we went to buy a house, she pulled the down payment out of her bra, we realized she's an A cup. Now, okay, you understand that's a joke, but I think sometimes an older generation might look at it and go, what? She was a D cup and then she became an A cup? What happened? they don't get it, So.
So you had this big break when Mitzi Shore made you a regular at the Comedy Store. What kind of material were you doing in those early days, and how did you find your way to stuff you were truly comfortable with doing that wasn't exploitative but did kind of draw on this really rich background that you had?
Well, when you first start out in comedy, I took a stand-up comedy class. Some people take classes, some people just go to open mics. But one thing I learned in the class early on, they said, talk about things that are unique to you, that make you different. So in the class, we would go around the class and you would say, I'm this, I'm that. And ultimately, we narrowed it down to, I am an Iranian American, someone who grew up in America with an Iranian background. So let me talk about some of those experiences. And early on, some of the jokes are hacky. I remember I had a joke where I would say, growing up as an Iranian in America, it was hard because as a kid, I could never get any of the other kids to spend the night because their parents were afraid that we might take them hostage. Silly things like that. And then I would do the act out with my mom calling their mom and saying, yes, we're going to keep Jesse for the night. And the mother saying, what? It's okay. It's just for the night until, you know, whatever. And they would be misconstruing that we're taking the kid hostage. So it was hacky, but it was what it was early on. And I think that early on you go to the ethnic thing and that's a very easy thing to differentiate you from others. And so that's what happened was when I auditioned for Mitzi Shore at the Comedy Store, I don't think she had any other comedians that came from my background or Middle Eastern background at all. So she was excited to have me as her, I think it was maybe her first Middle Eastern guy. There might have been one years before, but I was one of the first ones. And when I say she was excited, I'm saying that she had someone to fit that
the slot
quota. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the quota, yeah. Almost the slot. And Mitzi's always had these ideas. She's always been ahead of the game a lot. And I think what happened was at some point, Mitzi, who's Jewish, she had been watching the news. And there was the latest intifada with the Palestinians and the Israelis, and this was in 2000. And she goes, I think there's going to be a need for a positive voice of Middle Easterners and Muslims in America. So she wanted to put together a show and call it the Arabian Nights and have me and whatever other Middle Eastern comedians she could find and throw us all together. And she did that. She found Ahmed Ahmed and Aaron Cater and a few other Middle Eastern, and anyone actually who was brown that wasn't Latino or black ended up on our show. I'm not kidding. We had an Indian. We had Armenians. We had a white girl who knew how to belly dance. You name it, we had it. It was pretty funny. But the thing about Mitzi early on was when she first saw me when I auditioned for her, I talk about this in the book, when she made me regular, she... what happens is you audition for her, and then as you're walking out of the room, she's sitting right by the exit. And if she grabs your arm, that means she's going to make you a regular. If she lets you walk out, that means you did not make it. So you're hoping she grabs your arm, and I'm hoping, she finally grabs my arm. She pulls me close, and she says, you're very funny. That's how she talks. I go, thank you, Mitzi. And she goes, I'm going to make you a regular. I go, thank you, Mitzi. And she goes, have you ever thought about wearing the outfit? I go, outfit? I go, what outfit? She goes, you know, the hat and the gown. And I go, hat and gown? And I realized she wanted me to wear a turban and a dishdasha. Turban again on stage. And I go, and I think to myself, I go, okay, is this, do I say yes and sell out my people? Or do I stand strong? I go, Mitzi, that's ridiculous. And so I turn to her, I go, of course, yes, I will wear the outfit. And I walk out of the room and I think to myself, what did I just agree to? I just agreed to wear a turban on stage. And I was in this moment of feeling excited about being a regular, but then feeling miserable that I was going to have to wear a turban on stage. And it became this back and forth between me and the Comedy Store of me trying to get out of the turban. And finally, the way I got out of it was I called them one day and I said, listen, I've heard a story. There's an Iranian in Los Angeles who wears a turban and makes fun of the mullahs in Iran. And one of the events he was doing, some supporters of the mullahs showed up and threw a rock at him and blinded him. So I said, listen, I'll gladly wear the turban, but I'm afraid someone might come after me, and worse yet, they might come after the club. And that's when the club booker said, you know what, just wear something comfortable. Forget the turban. Just wear, you know, whatever you want. It's okay. So I got out of the turban that way.
And that story was patently false?
What's that? Actually, that story was a story that I'd heard.
Huh.
And back then, we didn't have Google. This was 2000, so there was no way for me to Google it. But it was a story that was circulating around the Iranian community. I think this poor guy is a real guy. But I didn't do my research to confirm it. I just, as soon as somebody told me, yeah, there's a guy that got hit by a rock, I go, I don't care who hit him, why, what, as long as he got hit wearing a turban, that's enough ammunition for me to go in and say, hey, turban equals rock throwing at your club. I just want you to know that right now.
My sense is that good comedy is always about more than just making people laugh, and very often it's got, you know, like really incisive points under it. At the same time, I wonder if, like, where you draw the line between, like, overthinking, I don't know, do I do the accent? Is that also perpetuating a stereotype, or do I do the accent because it's funny and then I can tell a larger story that actually makes people think? How do you navigate that?
You know, it's interesting. First of all, the stereotype that really bothers me is the terrorist thing. Mm-hmm. And I've said this before. I don't mind playing taxi drivers. I don't mind playing deli, falafel store owners. I don't mind playing these different parts. I'm actually playing Jafar in a Disney movie that's coming up this summer called The Descendants, where it's all about the kids of Disney villains. And when you read the script, you see that the kid of Jafar is a good kid. There's a good message in the movie. So I go, hey, I can do that. I don't mind doing that. The terrorist thing is what bothers me a lot. So I don't mind doing the accent on stage. I think that that's part of the act out. If you're talking about your mother or you're talking about someone who's got that accent, I think it's fun. I personally think that the playing the parts is what bothers me, playing the parts of the terrorists. And on stage, I make fun of the terrorists. I make fun of some of the social and political things. I do a lot of material now about my kids, which doesn't deal with any kind of ethnic stuff. Sometimes I will also make fun of the media coverage of people from that part of the world. So I think as long as there's a message underneath, which is this message that's... That shows us differently, I'm fine playing with the accent.
Actor, comedian, and writer Maz Jobrani is my guest. His new memoir is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer, actor, and comedian Maz Jobrani, whose new memoir is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You say, Maz, that if we can't afford therapy, but we want to sort of work through some stuff, we should sit down and write a memoir. How did this project change you?
It's amazing because in our day to day, we're so busy with nowadays, especially with the phone and the Twitter and the I don't know how you function, but I personally, when I'm with my phone and I have any kind of free time, I start fiddling with it and I'll check my Twitter, then I'll check my Facebook, then I'll check my email, then I'll go back to the Twitter in case anything came up while I was at Facebook. And it's this constant circle, and I never contemplate about a lot of the deeper issues that I may have in my life or I've had in the past. So when you are forced to write a book, or when you decide to write a book, forced meaning you have deadlines, it's an amazing experience. You start thinking about your childhood, you start thinking about things that influenced you. And there was moments in the book where I, especially when it comes to my father, again, I mentioned how he was this larger than life character who was helping everybody out. And I think about myself and I have this, here's a breakthrough. I have this feeling in myself that whenever anybody needs anything, any kind of loan or money or whatever, I always want to help out. And that goes back to my dad. But then I only look at that good side of what he did, which was he was helping people out. But the bad side was that he was careless in his finances and was then lost a lot of his money. So then I realized, and also, by the way, he was very rich and was able to afford to do a lot of this stuff. And I think of myself, when I was, for example, when I had that day job in the advertising agency and I was making very little money, I would go out to dinner sometimes with my boss and insist on paying because of who my father had been. I felt that there was this cultural thing that had been put on my shoulders that you need to be the man and step up and take care of any bill that comes up, not thinking, well, maybe sometimes you can't afford it, or maybe sometimes giving people money all the time doesn't help them in the long run because you're just putting a Band-Aid over an issue. So yeah, it's a very therapeutic experience, and I highly recommend everyone write a book, people. It helps.
I was charmed by the stories of your grandfather, who was here, spoke very little English, but apparently had friends like all over town who just thought he was the most delightful person.
Grandpa was an amazing person. Grandpa lived to be 98 or 100. We don't know because we didn't have a birth certificate because he'd been around for so long. And I think when you come from Iran to America, there's date changes. There was, I think at the revolution, the calendar changed. So nobody knew how old he was. And I jokingly say that we would just throw his birthday. Anytime it was someone's birthday, we just throw him in the mix. So he'd have like four birthdays a year, which put him at 280 years old. But he was amazing. He would wake up every morning, put on a three-piece suit, put on his fedora, and he would just get going. He was retired. He was living with us in Los Angeles. Didn't speak any English, but people understood him. People loved him. He had friends that were non-Farsi speaking. He had friends that were. We went with him one time to the farmer's market. And there was these Mexicans who didn't speak English. They spoke Spanish, but somehow Grandpa and these guys were buddies, and they communicated. I don't know how they did it. It was amazing. Grandpa would hand them his bags, the bag he'd brought. They would fill it with what he wanted without him saying a word. They would just fill it up with the oranges and the cucumbers and whatever it was. He'd go shopping. He'd come back. They'd say bye to each other. He was an amazing guy and an inspirational guy. And I talk about him in the book, and I also say how he was also very politicized, and he was very against the current regime, because what had happened was when the revolution first happened in Iran, he actually was supporting some of the protesters because there were young people protesting in the streets. So he thought, okay, this is good. People are going to get a little more of the wealth that the Shah has been taking, and this is a good thing. But as soon as the revolution happened, and people that had been in power started being executed, and there was a bloodbath, and the country went the way it went, Grandpa started cussing out the leadership in the bazaar. He would cuss out the leaders, and it got so bad that we had to actually get him out of Iran because we were feared for his life. So then he came to America, and he would listen to this Persian radio station that would report on all of the politics going on in Iran, and once in a while, this gentleman, this man in a three-piece suit and a fedora, who was this philosophical man whom I kind of compared him to Gandhi. He was this real forward-thinking man. He'd be sitting there listening to this radio station, talking about news in Iran, and the next thing you know, the worst cussing you've ever heard in your entire life, words I've never heard, he would start cussing at the regime, and we'd be like, whoa, 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 Grandpa, take it easy. And he would just say these things, and I'm like, oh my gosh. And it was just amazing that he went from this very eloquent, soft-spoken man to he was so angered by the regime that he would just lose it. And it was actually kind of amusing at times.
You didn't call him Grandpa, right? What do Iranians call their grandfathers?
Well, his last name is Farzaneh, so we call them Baba Farzaneh, which is Daddy Farzaneh, basically. Baba Farzaneh was his name.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Rebecca on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, good afternoon. I had a question. If I was trying to find out if whenever you and your family moved to America, if y'all all spoke very fluent English, or if there anything ever got lost in translation, or if y'all ever went to the store, if your parents ever made you or your sister translate for them.
Absolutely. I actually talk about that in my stand-up, about how it's not just the language, it's also the culture. But the language, when we first came to America, in Iran, I'd learned to speak English because I went to an international school. So I was just learning. I'd learned how to speak English, and I was just learning how to read and write in Farsi, but I knew how to read and write in English already. So when we came to America, we spoke English well. Our parents, not as much. And they had to, my mother went to a community college to learn. But it caused a little bit of problems as a kid. I remember very simple thing. We had pizza day at school, and everyone was assigned to bring something to make pizza in our third grade class. And I got assigned sausages. So I went grocery shopping with my mother and my aunts, and we're in the grocery store, and I say, I need to bring sausages. And in Farsi, saucisse is hot dogs. So my mom and my aunts go, well, then you got to bring hot dogs. And I said, okay, sounds good to me. Sausages, hot dogs. But the sausages you put on a pizza are, you know, it's not hot dogs. And so I showed up at the third grade class with hot dogs. And again, it's not a big deal hearing it as an adult, but as a third grader, when all the other third graders look at you and go, ha ha, he brought hot dogs. And I'm going, no, this is saucisse. And they're going, no, it's hot dogs. And I'm going, my mom told me this is sausage. And I'm like, that's not a sausage. And it became this thing. And I'm like, oh man, I have to go back to my mom and like crying, like, why would you give me hot dogs? And she's like, you said saucisse. So definitely there was a lot of translation, things that were lost in translation.
I mean, clearly you're fully, acculturated at this point. But I wonder if that causes you to be extra sensitive to the stuff that your own kids come home with a mimeographed sheet demanding for the class picnic or whatever. Are you really careful about that sort of thing?
Absolutely. You know, I again, talk about therapy. I go back and I think about stuff. I mean, one of the things my mom used to do, and I don't know if this is a cultural thing or if it's a generational thing. I think the generation we live in now, there's so much more research on how to raise your kids. Again, I talk about this in my stand-up where I say, now there's research, for example, that says if you want your kids to fall asleep by 7, you got to start the process at 5:30 because it's an hour and a half process and you have to go outside when they're playing and give them a 2-minute warning,
right?
Because you don't want to shock the kids. That's what I tell, and it works actually. I go out and I say, kids, 2 more minutes, and they go, okay, daddy. And then you go out and 2 minutes later, let's go in. They come in fine. But when we were kids, it was like, get in the house, go to sleep. I mean, my parents used to go to parties every night of the week and just take us with them. And I'd be exhausted, about to fall asleep. I'd be like, but I have to sleep. And my dad would say, you sleep at the party. So so that's where I came from. But I'm so sensitive now to some things. For example, my mom used to always show up late to pick me up. She would show up late, always. And I would constantly be sitting there waiting and thinking, they forgot about me. This is it. They left. I'm here. And I constantly went through that. So now I have a very sensitive thing with my kids where I'm never late. I'm always on time. I don't want them to be the last kid picked up. Things like that. Or like you said, getting things right. Like, I'm not going to send my kids to school with hot dogs when they need sausages. I guarantee you.
You had like a road not taken in your early adult life where you were enrolled in a PhD program, you were studying overseas. Like, what might you have done if you hadn't gone into the entertainment industry?
I really think I would have been a professor in political science. That's kind of the path I was going, because that was the compromise I'd made in my mind, because my parents wanted lawyer or doctor, which to them was something that was a formidable a reputable profession, something they could go to a party and tell their friends, my son is a doctor. What does your son do? A big percentage of it is just to look good within the community. So they wanted that. And I wanted actor and comedian. And I think somewhere I studied abroad in Italy in my junior year in college. And there was this professor and I just fell in love with what he was doing. And I said, that's a good way to go. I said, I can be in front of people. I can be around ideas and young people and just be invigorated in that way. But also, it's reputable. It's still a doctor. It's a PhD doctor. So that was the path I was going. I was going to be a professor in political science.
Do you ever think, what your life would look like today if that had been your choice?
It's funny. I've gone now to several different colleges and either performed or had seminars. I just recently, with the book, I did a talk and a book signing at Stanford. I did a talk at Harvard, UCSD. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm kind of having that professorial role without having to go through writing a dissertation in 5 years of study. I kind of won in that way.
When you make choices about what your kids are going to watch, knowing that there are so many negative stereotypes about people of Middle Eastern descent in this country, how careful do you have to be? I mean, I guess you're safe if you go to, like, you know, one of the kids' channels or something, but I wonder how often you find something and think, I cannot believe that this has been packaged for children and this is the way my people are being represented.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, it's amazing how animation has some of the best integrated characters. You've got Dora the Explorer. You've got, there's a Chinese, I forget her name right now, Mi Hai Kao, I forget her name, but there's a Chinese character. There's bears. I mean, there's all kinds of characters. And it's such an accepted, I'm very impressed with animation. I think that they're ahead of the game when it comes to integrating programming. I don't mind. I don't think they've seen Aladdin yet, but I don't mind if they do. I think that the beauty of the generation that my kids are growing up in, I'm Iranian, my wife is Indian, so they're already mixed. Our neighbor is a black father and a white mother, and my son is best friends with their son. So it's amazing. They're in this culture where color and all this stuff is not an issue to them. It's really nice to see. Again, I just go back to my biggest pet peeve is the terrorist thing. And I just feel that the unfortunate thing is, if you think about it, for example, take ISIS, for example, it's such a small number of people, but they take up so much of the news that if you were to just watch the news, I mean, we've seen it on Fox News now where they've come and said, oh, there's no-go zones for where Muslims have taken over, or it's constant ISIS, ISIS, ISIS. So you forget that there's probably 99% of the population of Middle Easterners and Muslims and people from that part of the world are just ordinary people. They're not terrorists. So imagine if the only news that the rest of the world saw for America were gangbangers or serial killers, and that's all they saw 99% of the time. Well, every time an American would go to the Middle East, Middle Easterners would look at the guy and think, uh-oh, serial killer. So that's my biggest pet peeve, is this terrorist stereotype that I try to steer clear from and also not show my kids.
The new book by actor, writer, and comedian Maz Jobrani is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. Maz, it's been such a pleasure, and I really appreciate you making the time for us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, with help on the phones today from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.